Hello and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the advertising and marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society, and I'm Mark Renikus.
Hi, and I'm Paul Jacobs, and in this episode we're talking hospitality post-COVID to find out what it's like in the pub and restaurant trade as we emerge from lockdown.
And we've got two guests who I think possibly have the most informed, certainly the most interesting point of view in terms of talking about hospitality in the UK. First, I'd like to welcome Nick McKenzie, CEO of Green King, the UK's leading pub retailer and brewer, 2,700 plus Green King venues across the UK, and it's a £2.2 billion a year business. So I think it's safe to say, Nick, that Green King is part of the fabric of our society. Welcome. Hello. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. Really happy to be here.
You've got a strong track record in the hospitality industry, starting at Burger King, but fascinating to hear, I'm sure we'll touch on, 12 years at Merlin Entertainment as well, where you were leading brands including Madame Tussauds, Legoland, Sea Life and the London Eye. So let's talk about that later.
Yeah, look, it's been an interesting transition for me. So, going to be good to talk a little bit about my background, a little bit about the plans for Green King as well.
And I'd like to welcome our second guest, Jeremy Scarfe, CEO of Keen Brands, a design and communications expert for the hospitality sector. So hello, welcome, Jeremy. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, it's great to be here.
And I can see you've got quite an impressive list of hospitality clients. To rattle off a few, Costa Coffee, Hilton, Nando's, Marriott, Pret, and of course, Green King, which we'll get into kind of that conversation. So it'd be certainly well-placed to have a good chat today, Jeremy.
Yeah, I think all of our clients have faced a lot of challenges, and we, as a service provider to the hospitality sector, have certainly faced some significant challenges. But, you know, I think there's opportunity there as well, so it'd be good to talk about how we're adapting.
Great. And even though the pubs and restaurants have reopened, Mark and I are still working from home. We're all chatting on Zoom right now, as we have been for the last few months. So to kick us off, I think it's always a good place to start, is to ask how lockdown has been. And I'll come to you first, Nick. How has lockdown been for you, both personally and professionally? And we'd love to hear a bit more what you learned and will hopefully take forward from this.
We were thrown into a really, really difficult situation that nobody had any experience of. You know, you go through crisis management procedures and policies and, you know, have lots of plans about how you deal with these sort of things. But in reality, when you get to it, it's very much taking it day by day. I've actually quite enjoyed elements of it, and not the real difficult challenges, but the working from home, spending more time, I guess, with my family together as a unit, which has been great. And actually, I think we've been pretty effective in the way we've worked as a company. And fortunately, about 6 months prior to this happening, we put teams in across the whole, Microsoft teams in across the whole of the business. And that has been, really, really, really important part of the way we've communicated. What have I learned? I mean, I think the biggest thing for me is communications. When you're in this sort of situation where you've got, 38,000 employees, as we do, and trying to communicate to 38,000 people about what's happening and what, is changing on a day-to-day basis has been tough. But, we've really risen to the challenge, and we've used a lot of video, we've been doing vlogs, and we've over-communicated. And I think the biggest thing I'll take from it is that the more you can communicate to teams and get to teams and be honest with them and tell them, what is happening, good or bad, then the more chance you've got of coming through it. That's been borne out in the response that we've had from our teams as they've come back. They've been very appreciative of the level of constant communication they've had, and been told many, many times, just be honest with us and tell us what's happening.
You look at any news publication, the reopening of pubs is not far from the top of the news. So how's that been for you? What's the biggest challenges you've found as you've slowly reopened the Green King estate?
I think the first thing that was really tough, actually, and it goes back to the communications point, is, a lot of speculation. All the time there was comments coming out about pubs, and, that is the good and bad thing about pubs. They are very high on the list of what papers want to write about. We had a lot of our teams being upset at some of the speculation. A lot of people, maybe getting ahead of themselves because of speculation about when we were going to reopen, and actually tempering some of that speculation and tempering some of those comments was probably the hardest bit initially. There's a lot of practical challenges about, you know, opening 1,700 managed, 1,000 tenanted pubs, and that was tough. You know, getting beer, and we'll talk about beer, I guess, later on, but getting beer out of pubs when you've closed your whole estate down is incredibly difficult. So particularly when you've got lots of deep cellars, you know, they can drop big kegs of beer into a cellar. It's very difficult to get them out again. So that was one of our biggest challenges. We managed to work it out, and we were one of the few businesses in the industry actually who managed to get most of its beer out and not have to destroy it in cellar. So from an environmental perspective, we were able to then dispose of it in an environmentally friendly way, whereas many people had to pour beer down the drain, which has its big problems. So that was tough. And just the logistics of reopening, getting the supply chain moving, getting the whole team behind what do we have to do to get open safely, has been a massive challenge. And I guess we'll talk about it later. But, you know, we were helping government to create the guidelines, but the final guidelines that came out were very, very late. So really you were second guessing what the guidelines were going to say and what you had to put in the pub. So, you know, we used that as an opportunity to say, right, how can we rethink the whole customer journey and put safety into that customer journey, put takeaway and delivery into that journey. And it was actually a really good opportunity to rethink the way we run the business. So lots of challenges, too many to talk about here. You'll be bored by the end of it. But I think those were some of the biggest ones that we had to deal with.
Well, talking about challenges, maybe for me it would be easier to understand it on a personal level. And genuinely, in the village I was brought up in, there's a Green King pub, and it was a really important part of the community. Still is. It's called the Badger Box in Kirkby and Ashfield. I'll be going there next weekend when I go and see my mum. So, put it simply, what is going to be different when I go to the Badger, as we call it, next weekend?
Yeah, look, you will notice differences, but you know what we've tried to do is to get a balance between safety and maintaining, you know, the atmosphere and the essence of a pub. And you know that again, as we have reopened, probably has been one of our biggest challenges. We do like research literally every 2 weeks with focus groups and some qual as well around understanding what people's concerns are about coming back to the pub, and you face a real dichotomy, I guess, of people's views. You've got, you know, maybe you're hardened drinkers, and I don't know whether you're the, you know, go to the pub every night hardened drinker.
I'm a Coke Zero bloke, so no, not really.
Yeah, and you know those guys don't want any change. You know, they just want to see the same thing. Whereas you've got people at the other end of the spectrum who are very nervous about coming back to the pub, who just want to see, you know, lots and lots of safety initiatives to make them feel comfortable. So trying to balance that off has been tough. But, you know, what you should see when you walk in there is, these are the things that will be different, is, you know, you will see quite a lot of signage talking about a thing called PubSafe that we've put across the whole of our estate, which is basically 5 promises to our customers and to our teams about how we're going to keep them safe. And we took an early decision that we were going to put that across the whole managed estate. And obviously I won't go through all the detail, but you know, what will be slightly different in this pub, you're likely to be greeted as you arrive. We'll ask you for your contact details for the track and trace system, which we've done through, in most cases, through an app. You'll be handed a menu. If it's a food pub, I think it's a locals pub, actually, it's probably less likely to have a menu, but you know, you'll be handed a menu, which won't be the same menus as you've seen before. There'll be paper menus and disposable menus, and you'll be asked to go and be seated, use hand sanitizer, etc. So those sort of things will be pretty different, and you know, it's taking time for people to get used to that. Obviously, we've had to lose some capacity in the pubs. You're not allowed to stand up at the bar and have a drink. You'll have to be seated, and we've lost capacity because we've had to spread tables for social distancing. So in most cases, though, that hasn't made an enormous difference to the feel of the pub. We have some plastic screens on our bars, particularly at the tills. We ask our customers, where possible, to use our order and pay app. And I think about 30% of our customers are now using that app, which is quite a big step forward. And where possible, we're asking people to use contactless payments. So you know, all the things you've probably read about, I would say we are probably doing more than most, actually, in terms of our position on safety. We are mandating our staff to wear some form of face covering if they're delivering food to a table. But we then have left it to the discretion of our teams to wear face coverings if they want them elsewhere around the business, unless you're in a situation where you're at less than 1 meter, then you do need to wear it. So quite a few changes. We've had really strong feedback on it. 98% of the customers we surveyed said that they felt safe coming back into our pubs after we'd opened, and there was about 6,000 in that survey. So we're going to stick to our guns on this. We think it's really, really important that we maintain a visual presence around safety. And the sort of biggest manifestation of that is we have in every single one of our pubs what we call a pub safe monitor, whose job it is to go and clean tables, clean toilets, to make sure there is cleanliness visibly around the business. And that's cost a significant amount of money, but we believe it's really, really important. Long answer, but I don't want to miss anything out.
No, that's really important because, as I've said, you have such a massive estate. Effectively, I think you are the barometer of the hospitality trade. And on that note, have you seen any regional differences in terms of how consumers are responding to things?
Yeah, we're a few weeks in. Overall, I'm pretty happy with where we are. I think trading has been better than I thought it would be. You know, I think Eat Out to Help Out, and I guess we'll talk about that, has been a massive help, and fair play to the government for putting that in place. You know, therefore the trading patterns around the week are quite different now, but also there are lots of regional differences. The most pronounced, and I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear this, is London. We have opened about 60% of our estate in London, and I think we're probably either the biggest or second biggest in terms of numbers for London pubs. And particularly central London, West End, City, you know, big office areas particularly are really, really struggling. You know, and in some cases, 70-80% down like for like. And there is about 100% delta between the like for likes we're seeing in the rest of the estate versus London. And, you know, that is a massive issue. And for the reasons we all know, which is no one's going back to the offices in London, tourists are not in London. And I think the governments have got a big, big job on their hands to solve people coming back to, you know, what we know is the sort of, you know, the epicenter of most of our economy, or some of our economy, but particularly the hospitality economy. And, you know, we're working with government to try and improve that situation. And then you go to other regional variances. You know, I think there's no real pattern. You couldn't say north or south, but there's certainly differences between the way Scotland's traded versus the way England's traded because of some of the restrictions. And there's some differences around wet-led pubs versus the more food-led pubs. But I would say the biggest variant outside of London has been pubs with gardens. And, you know, we have a lot of big pub gardens, which has been good for us, and it's helped us through that, and the weather's been pretty favourable as well. So yes, there's some regional variances, but you know, there's a lot more in, you know, the sort of general way of trading, whether it's wet-led, dry-led, or whether it's pubs with gardens that are having an impact.
And how will you react if there is, unfortunately, an infection spike that's linked to one of your pubs?
We've been very much followed guidance from government, you know, not I would say to the letter, but, you know, we've tried to be very, very true to what the government's asking hospitality business and the wider community to do. So, you know, we will react by working with Public Health England, working with local government to make sure we understand it, to make sure, you know, we'll close the pub. You know, if you find out that there is an outbreak that's come from a pub, then you're going to close it. And we'll close it down, we'll clean it, we'll make sure it's safe, and we'll get it back open, but only doing that in line with consultation with the authorities in that area. And we've already had situations where, you know, we haven't been found at the centre of it, but, you know, where members of the public and members of staff have had positive tests, not necessarily in the pub, but outside of the pub, and we've reacted in the way that we always react to this stuff, and that's taking it very seriously and probably being quite conservative, actually. We're not going to go gung-ho and try and push things through for one pub. And you know, I think the challenge for the industry is that there's a lot of talk about pubs and whether pubs, you know, are causes of infection outbreaks. There's very little evidence to support that. You know, we have a very low level of infection rates in our staff members. And that even and that was true prior to the lockdown as well, relative to the rest of the country and the rest of the communities. So I think, you know, a lot of people are talking about pubs versus schools, and I just think that's completely missing the point. I don't think that is the point about this. I think it is very much about how we react locally and how, you know, responsible we are in terms of the way we operate our pubs and keep them safe.
Lots of people I've spoken to are really taking forward some of the things that we've done in lockdown. Do you think there is any part of the experience that, you know, when we have a vaccine and as far as we know, we're in the clear, is there any part of the experience you are going to take forward with you? And I'm also interested to hear how you might, in the medium term, be innovating in London if you're not getting the traditional trade that you used to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there is quite a bit, actually. I mean, we've accelerated a lot during lockdown. We took the decision at the start that we sort of set three objectives for the business. One was around its maintaining its financial stability. Second one was about our people, about making sure that we shelter our people from the worst, you know, the worst of what this crisis can create. And the third one was to try and come out the strongest in the industry. And we took a decision to run about 35 projects during lockdown, not all big projects, but strategic projects. And delivery and takeaway for us was one of those projects. We ended up, coming into the crisis, we hadn't done a lot on delivery and takeaway. We started some trials that had gone pretty well. But on opening, we had about 700 pubs with takeaway, you know, a full takeaway customer journey. And actually, you know, relatively quickly now we'll have every pub having a takeaway option in there based around an order and pay app. So, you know, and the same with delivery, we've linked up with Just Eat, who we weren't working with prior to the lockdown, and also Deliveroo. And you know, about 400 of our pubs now have delivery. So we would never have done that without this situation. So, you know, we're going to learn from that and see how effective that's been and how much we can take that forward. You know, and I think the other interesting fact is that our customer scores are higher now than they've ever been. So our TripAdvisor scores, we monitor across all social platforms. You know, there's no secret in this. You know, we have more labour in our business right now. So we have a pub safe monitor and we have someone greeting at the door. And I think there's a connection there. So whilst we've got to get the balance right on labour within the business, you know, I think actually more personal service and more overt cleaning in the business has got to be something that we want to do more of. So lots of lessons there. I mean, there's a myriad of things that we've taken from this that will push into the business going forward. But I would say those are the two biggest ones. It's early days on London. We had actually taken the decision to take London out of our what we called our locals business, which had about 1,000 pubs in it. This is for the managed estate, and put it into a new division called Premium Urban and Venture Brands, because we felt that we weren't really doing enough with a number of our London pubs. They're very, very similar. You know, a lot of nearby locations, and we need to start thinking about differentiation. So I think that, you know, that is actually going to be the biggest part of what we do going forward once London settles down, is to understand how we can differentiate some of our pubs a little bit more and think more about how we localise them and reflect the sort of customer base in that area. So we're not thinking right now about sort of design side of innovation. We're just thinking more about segmentation of that London market. And I think it'll become much clearer once we know longer term what the impact of COVID is, whether people, you know, businesses are going to come back, whether tourism is going to come back to the extent that it did. And then we'll take a view from there.
Jeremy, coming to you, one thing we can certainly say the pandemic has done has made us look kind of what other countries are doing. And as someone that works globally in the hospitality sector, What have you seen that we can learn from that kind of other countries and cultures are doing to tackle COVID, certainly within the hospitality sector?
I think it's very varied and actually probably not as rigorous as some of the excellent measures Nick was talking about. Middle East, where we've got a studio in Dubai, quite a good client base, they have struggled with infection levels. So they released from lockdown and then had to enforce it again. And that pattern happened a couple of times. So I think people have struggled to feel confident about going out. There is a choice of measures, I think, probably best describes it, being put in by operators rather than a standardization. So it's a lot, I think, on the personal customer's confidence in terms of going out. But we're starting to see some quite interesting areas of innovation. So we're working on currently in Saudi Arabia the world's largest mixed-use development, which is going to be opened in 3 years' time. And the conversations there, the whole theme is about wellness. There's 26 hotels going in, so it's a big investment, and there's going to be hundreds of restaurants. But space design has been affected by COVID, and how the personal customer space area and what we're designing into that, not just in high ends, but all the way through. And it's quite interesting where you're not taking an existing legacy space, such as Green King Pub, where you've got to reduce capacity, but how you then play out a wider management of that space, a cleverer management of that space, because you haven't got the legacy issues to deal with, to try and provide an ongoing comfort and I guess security, peace of mind for people, because what we still don't know is how long, you know, this is going to last. You know, the vaccine isn't necessarily going to come. It's not necessarily going to be effective. It's not necessarily going to be available in all areas, and the disease can morph and things like that. So hygiene, I think, is something that will just become part of the design process and part of the operator's mindset, that we have to bring what was seen as kind of back of house cleaning into the front of house arena, but also design of space to enable people to feel comfortable in that is definitely going on. But we're seeing some quite interesting things from a technology perspective. Certainly automation seems to be becoming a bigger aspect. So robotic arms making coffee and cocktails. I'm sure we've all seen the videos of that, but also table service and that. But that was happening before COVID, but there's an interest in driving that a little bit further forward. And some quirky stuff too, you know, some clever restaurants in Amsterdam where they just bought a lot of secondhand greenhouses and just put them outside on the canal side to create these really lovely little private dining spaces that are not expensive and quite exciting, because you're right out in the space of the street. So I think people are responding with some good ideas.
And Jeremy, you have your own business, hospitality business, Crossbrows. I'll confess I haven't been, but I'll be adding that to the list. I'm a regular through Waterloo, so I'll be checking that out. So, I mean, how's that been for you as an experience as a hospitality business owner, and equally kind of with your profession, has that helped shape the guidance you give to your clients?
It does. It gives us credibility as well, because we've got some experience to fall back on, and the guys have been amazing there. They've done a great job. I mean, as an operator, you suddenly see, okay, in a very small microcosm, just the dramatic change that it's meant to their business. And as a designer, you're kind of slightly insulated from that. You're not at the front line, but just seeing how you can go from doing, you know, tens of thousands a week to doing nothing, and the potential effect of that on the stability of the business. But it's a really great business, and they've pivoted effectively into delivery, into takeaway. And what they've seen actually is, as they've opened up, is those sides of the business have reduced. So they've got a very loyal customer base who just couldn't come in, but still wanted the product. And then have returned to the restaurant. And yes, in a reduced way. So delivery is still important, takeaway is still important, but they've seen an ongoing loyalty. And I think this connection to brand and connection to experience and great service. And we're seeing through the pub side, you know, the importance of community and neighbourhoods and local pubs and how they're responding. It's the same for our restaurant in Waterloo. There's a neighbourhood there and people are related to that. They might be travelling through every day and not living nearby, but they're treating it as a friend in their locality of operation. And as we look for other sites for that, there's a whole new... The conversation that we're having about, well, where do we go next is now completely changed. It's not just all about, right, it's got to be in the West End. It's much more about how do we connect to people in communities and look at different locations and different ways of delivering the product to them.
And on the innovation question, Nick, I'll come to you as well. And you mentioned some of your special projects. Has lockdown kind of helped you be like, okay, let's fast track that project or fast track an element of innovation that you maybe kind of wouldn't have pushed forward?
The app that we have, the Green King app now, that allows you to do order and pay, for quite a period of time was number one on the free downloads on the App Store. So, you know, it was fabulous. And we were, you know, we were at about two and a bit million downloads of that app. So, you know, we were probably at 200,000 prior to lockdown. And then your ability to adapt that, and I'll be honest, you know, we need to do work on it, but the key was get it in quickly, have it as being functional. But our focus now is very much, how do we develop it? How do we develop the customer experience? How do we innovate through it? How do we use it as a more of a loyalty tool? Would have taken us 12 to 18 months, no doubt about it. So, and other areas that we've been focusing on, and Jeremy touched on them, you know, as we know, costs, you know, even before this in the industry were a big challenge. We were facing a lot of cost headwinds. Efficiency and productivity continue to be a big challenge, and looking at technology solutions for how we can make our teams more effective, how we can run the business more effectively, and how we can, you know, manage some of the costs so we can allow our people to be front of house, not back of house, and to be doing, you know, productive work that the customer sees. Has been a real focus, and we'll definitely take that out as we go into the next few months. The other thing we've also had time to do is to look at our brand propositions, and you know, Jeremy has been working with us on some of this. But you know, we have four or five big brands that have not had a lot of focus on their future brand propositions, and we've been able to take the time to really step back and look at that, look at some of the historic research, understand that. And start to plan for the future. And that will, again, I hope, hold us in really good stead.
As you know, the podcast is shared by the Marketing Society. You mentioned brand proposition. Why don't we pick that up? Because one of the questions I've had from the people who sent in questions is, please tell us about the Green King proposition. So you're both working on it by the sound of it. Who wants to start with that one?
I'll better start off. I guess the challenge we have... as a number of businesses do, and my previous business, Merlin, had this, is, you know, the Green King brand proposition has a lot in it. It's a broad church. So we brew and we have brands that sit within that. So brands like Old Speckled Hen, Green King IPA, and many, many more. But we've then got brands within our pub business. So, you know, we have Farmhouse Inns, for example. We've got Hungry Horse, we have Chef and Brewer. So trying to work out the hierarchy of those brands with the name and the brand Green King is quite challenging. So we tend to go back to the individual brands and work on individual brand propositions. My view, and this sort of comes from my Merlin days, at the end of the day, the brand proposition is delivered predominantly through its people. And, I think our people... perhaps over time in certain of our brands have sort of lost sight of some of the key tenets of the brands. So what we've taken the time to do is to really refresh that, really understand the purpose of the brand and really understand some of the key pillars of it, and make sure that is really, really understood by as many or all of our employees, to make sure they're living that brand day to day. We have, seen some of the holes in some of our brands. I've spent a rather significant amount of money, and this is my big thing right now, is particularly in Chef and Brewer, actually, is we have spent money over lockdown on toilets. And it sounds a very strange thing to say, but you know, some of the toilets in that business just did not represent the brand. So we've done 100, actually, because, would you believe, toilets are really difficult to refurbish when a pub's open. So we took the opportunity to do that. And that, you know, that was because people have lost sight of the fact that, you know, that part of the experience was not working. And, you know, people were not coming to our business because of that. So minor example, but it's just given us an opportunity to really think that through, make sure our training's right, making sure people are understanding of the brand proposition, as you know, perhaps gives us a real opportunity to think differently and to do things differently. So, you know, we to answer a difficult question, we push it through individual brands. We have Green King IPA, which is obviously the name that people associate with Green King, and we've been doing a lot of work on those on that brand and with our other beer brands while we've been on lockdown, and you'll start to see some of the fruits of that labour over the coming weeks. But it's been a good time to be able to step back.
Still with Marketing Society questions, I'm going to be a bit creative with them. Some specifically for you, Nick. One of the focuses for the Marketing Society is leadership. I'd like you to cast your mind back to your childhood, you know, when you were at school. Were there any early signs that Nick was going to be a leader? If so, what were they?
No, there was absolutely none. It was it's a really interesting question. It's hard to sort of go back to that age and pick them out. I think if I really look back on it, and by the way, as you get to sort of the position that I'm in and some of the roles you get into, you tend to go through a lot of these assessments where people look back into your history and try and understand why you've ended up where you are and your suitability going forward. So I've been through a few of those and thought about this, but I think there's two or three things for me that sort of go back into my childhood, go back into, you know, why I think I'm here. And I think over the years, I've had an ability to mix and work with lots and lots of different types of people, and to be able to adapt to different people and, you know, different backgrounds, you know, different disciplines, and be able to work and maybe adapt myself actually to the way other people are and the other people need me to be as a leader. So I think over the years, I've been able to build that as a skill. I think over the years, and again, it does go back a little bit to my childhood, I was quite shy actually when I was younger, and until I was up into my, I guess, early 20s, I was pretty shy. And I think because of that, people tended to underestimate me a little bit. And what I've always tried to do is to exceed people's expectations of me, and, you know, and think that way. And I think that definitely came from my childhood, and therefore has probably driven me. Actually, my dad was quite a driven person, and I think he was in a pretty, you know, pretty similar place. And I do see some aspects of my father in me when I look at my leadership behaviour. But you know, I've tried, and again, I guess a little bit like this as a kid. I've tried to be as open and honest as I can be as a leader, and to lead with integrity. And that's certainly something I learned from my days in Merlin, you know, hard business, and we always took hard decisions and were quite challenging of each other. But integrity became a really important part of that business. And I've taken that into Green King as well, that, you know, openness, honesty and integrity go a long way in leadership.
So looking back to the 10-year-old Nick, what advice would you give him now?
Yeah, another toughie that you have to think hard about. I think it's actually about believing in yourself. It's, you know, I said pretty shy, and I didn't believe in myself until, you know, into my 20s actually. And I wish I'd done that a bit sooner. I think, you know, maybe I could have done a little bit better a little bit sooner and maybe made a difference. But, you know, as a leader, you always have doubt and you always have self-challenge, and I've done that over the years. But I think as time's gone on, I've learned to believe in myself a bit more, and to maybe go with your instincts a bit more and stop worrying about what people think of you. Go with your instincts, go with, you know, your experience, and believe in yourself. And that's 100% what I would have said to myself, said now to me as a 10, 12, 15 year old.
And a similar question, if you could have chosen anybody, and I think it's like a dinner party question really, alive or dead, to have been your mentor, who would they have been and why?
I'm not big at looking back actually on this sort of stuff. I've been really lucky with the majority of my jobs of having a boss that has mentored me, has believed in me, which I think was quite important given my previous comment, and has helped me develop. Starting off from a guy called John Longdon, who was the property. I'm a surveyor by profession. My background's property. There's a guy called John Longdon who runs an organisation now called Pub is the Hub, but he was quite big in the industry and when I was at Bass PLC. And he really believed in me, actually. And I still talk to him now about this. And he really promoted the importance of culture and the importance of, and actually property in those days in inside a business, which has gone with me a long way. And then working with Nick Varney at Merlin for 12 years was incredible. And learned an amazing amount from him. So, almost like my boss has been my mentor, and I haven't really looked beyond that. The one thing, as I was thinking this through, and it goes back to my previous comments about confidence, is that I have always struggled, and you've done well to get me on this sometimes. Is that I have struggled with public speaking and just pushing myself out there in a really proactive way. I'm sort of quite reserved in that sense, so I don't go and do a lot of public speaking. But I remember quite recently seeing something on Barack Obama, his ability to craft a narrative and to craft a speech in a way that, you watch some of his speeches and it is absolutely incredible how he creates a narrative and builds support. And, as a leader of a big business, you have to develop that ability to create a narrative and bring people with you. And whilst, I'll do it, it's the hardest thing that I do in my day-to-day working life for me. If I had him as a mentor around creating a narrative and being able to be an amazing orator, then I'd certainly go with him.
A constant theme amongst the marketing society that I love is bravery. And so the question that they want me to ask you is, what's the bravest decision you've taken, Nick?
I think there's probably two in my career, and this is more personal than it is sort of business. I talked before about being in property. All my career, actually, I was in property in Bass and then into Burger King when I was at Diageo and then into Merlin. And it was always property development, construction, all that sort of stuff. And I think the bravest decision I took, again, supported by a mentor in Nick at Merlin, was to switch from being a property person to being someone who had responsibility for a P&L to go and be an operator. The world is littered with property people who've tried to go into business, wider business and general management, and it hasn't really worked out. And that was a big old move for me. So I was, moving from running a development function into run a theme park business, as it was at the time, with businesses like Alton Towers and many other around Europe. And that was a big shift. And I wouldn't have been where I am now unless I made that shift. So I actually think that was, looking back on my career, was just go for it, believe in yourself, make it happen, and have someone to support you through it. And that worked well. And which sort of led me into Merlin to continue my career in Merlin, but ultimately led to me coming to Green King. And coming out of Merlin and taking the Green King job was a big, bold decision for me. To be a first-time CEO of a FTSE 250 business, as it was then, and B, to just take that risk and take that leap into being a CEO generally. And I've learned over the years, if you don't make big decisions, big things don't happen. And I'm glad I did make that move. I'd been in Merlin for 12 years, and it's part of my life. And it was quite a hard move away from that, but to come to such a big and great business as Green King was a big step. So I'll probably put those two as being my bravest decisions. I could have stepped away from both of them, but I'm glad I didn't.
You talked about Merlin, Nick. So let's ask you a bit more about that. I think some obvious parallels between Merlin and Green King, and I guess having spent 12 years there, kind of how has being at Merlin shaped your kind of strategy and the role you've taken at Green King?
I think it starts with culture. I mean, I think one of the strongest things of the sort of history of Merlin is that the culture that we were able to create there and Nick was able to create there was incredible. Staff turnover levels were very, very low in Merlin, and senior management turnover was incredibly low. And people bought into, you know, the product, bought into the story of Merlin, but, you know, ultimately bought into the brands and what you were delivering for customers day in, day out, which was memorable experiences. So, we'd managed to create this culture that people really, really believed in. There was a very positive culture, the high integrity culture. And I, you know, my first step into Greene King was we need to do something with the culture of this business. Very successful business. CEO had been in charge for a very long time, done an amazing job actually of creating this, you know, this really, really successful company. But my job was to get to say, right, how do you create the next chapter of Greene King? I wanted to change the culture from a very margin-led, very, you know, results-oriented business, which is very important. But I wanted to change that to something that was a little bit more customer-focused and a little bit more people-focused. So I did a whole process actually over about 12 months of reintroducing a purpose and a set of values into the business that can really guide us for the next 10 to 12 years. And, you know, our purpose is pouring happiness into lives. And that's what I want to do with the whole of the business to make sure whether it's a customer or members of staff that people are really happy within our business. And, you know, that's the culture we're working on right now. And we're starting, actually, I think COVID has moved us on probably, you know, 6 to 9 months from where we would have been had that not come about. So it starts with culture, then leads on to brands. Merlin was very much a brand-led business, and making sure our brands are strong and the propositions that sit behind those brands are strong. And that's been a lot of our focus. And then we will get on to innovation and just being a bit more creative around what other customer experiences can we bring. And, you know, some of our focus around research, some of our focus around, really understanding our customer base has come from Merlin.
You talked a lot about culture and people, and I fully expect diversity and inclusion to be kind of very, very high on that agenda. Can you tell us a bit more kind of what Greene King are doing to be more diverse and inclusive?
Yeah. Look, inclusion actually had always been pretty good to a degree within Greene King. I think we've done a lot on social mobility. There's lots of some really good initiatives going on the inclusion agenda, but was at the fairly early stages of its formation. I think the pub industry and the pub sector has got lots to do on this, actually. I think, you know, and Greene King is 100% part of that. We need to really be a leader in this area, I think. And we'd started to do quite a lot of work on it, particularly around gender diversity, and you know, all the other areas that, you know, fit within the inclusion agenda. I think one of the areas we probably hadn't been as good as we could have been, and that was really, you know, borne out in the situation I'll talk about in a minute that came into the press, is race diversity has been a bit of a challenge for us. And I think it's probably, you know, it is actually one of the hardest ones for companies to get hold of and really grip and make a difference with. So we'd started an agenda around trying to improve race diversity in the business, you know, to reflect our customer base, to reflect, you know, to a degree our employee base. When we then got a telephone call from the Telegraph, who you probably saw did a piece on our history where Benjamin Green, who goes back way into our history, had an involvement in the slave trade, which we knew about, but had also received compensation when he lost things from that slave trade business, which was really difficult for us. And obviously a lot of other companies, because of the high profile of Black Lives Matter, got drawn into this. And, you know, in it was a tough time for us, actually. We had to really look at ourselves. And as you know, we came out and said, look, we can't do anything about our history and our past, but what we can do is work on our future. And it's really helped us to step change our thinking around inclusion in the business, particularly around the BAME communities and the Black communities within Greene King and within the communities in which we operate. So, I think the bit of advice I would give is, A, don't knee-jerk in a situation like that. We came out and said, look, we will put a substantial investment into our inclusion program, particularly around BAME and particularly around black communities. And we've taken our time. So we've developed a strategy. We've listened. We've brought some outside influence into the business to help us. So it was very clear that the little group that I set up were all white. And didn't live in communities or understand communities that we wanted to try and get involved with. So we brought some external help in. We've worked with our existing charity partners to try and understand how we can put more programs in place with them to support particularly the black community, and how we can bring more employees from the black community into our business. And we've started to work on programs with them and put investments into them. And we've also put together an employee on ELG, an employee listening group, where we had many, many people who said, I want to be involved in this within the company, from all parts, from all walks of life. And that community has just started to come together, and they've got a group that we funded to really help us in working out, you know, what is going to be a long-term investment and long-term initiative to bring more people from the BAME community into our business and support more of the communities around our pubs, particularly that operate in those communities. So, you know, we're about 20% along the journey, but, you know, we are absolutely committed to leading the industry on this and trying to push really hard to bring social mobility, but social mobility particularly in that community into play.
And you touched on, Nick, the kind of response you gave to Green King's history. How was that response received?
I'll be honest, it was very mixed. And I think that is a reflection of our community and this country, actually. It shocked me a little bit, if I'm being honest. I got a very polarised response to what we said and what we did, from incredible positivity internally, from the team saying this is absolutely the right thing to do. You come out and recognise the problem and then say you're going to deal with it. But it's sad to say I had a significant number of emails that said that I was doing the wrong thing, that we were bowing down to pressure, etc. And I was shocked by that, if I'm being honest, and it was actually quite difficult to deal with. And I think it woke me up to the fact that we've still got a massive job to do around racial diversity, because there is still a proportion of this population in this country who don't believe that's what we should be doing, and they need to be educated and they need to be told that, you know, what they're saying, what they're doing is not right. And we're going to stand up for that. So, you know, it was positive in one sense, but it shocked me a little that not everyone shared our view.
I'd like to talk about the future of the high street, and it's something that Paul and I are both passionate about, and you'll know where we stand from the line of my questioning. Jeremy, what role do you think hospitality can play in a future high street?
I think, Mark, it's going to play one of the only roles. I think we're transitioning at such a pace from hospitality and restaurants providing an adjunct to a retail occasion or a leisure occasion. And those high streets, you know, as we talked about a little bit earlier, and when you go out into the heart of the cities, there is nobody around. And whilst that might be a situation that's just right now, I don't think we're going to see the same kind of return to where it was before, just for so many reasons. But the retail community and the retail sector is really going to struggle, and the high street itself is going to be under a lot of pressure. Now, I think what we can bring as operators, as creative hospitality, as people passionate about eating and drinking and restaurants, is an experience that can inhabit the heart of our cities that might not be in the same format that was convenient for the landlords, was able to be put into a mall, was able to be lined up in a restaurant, in a high street situation. I think it's going to be much more fluid than that, and it's going to people are going to want change. People are going to want to have different experiences. It's not just going to be the same suspects of the same branded restaurants that people really end up with the same Italian experience with just a different name over the door. People are going to want to see some different things. They're going to want to have something different every week that they come down to the experience. So I think that the rise of the pop-ups, the more kind of festival orientation around food events and communities and really celebrating what we're just talking about, diversity, but also diversity in food and food culture is a really strong part of that. So I think it's going to be a really changed place, and the structures that are familiar to us in terms of the high streets will start to change, and hopefully food can be right at the heart of that change.
Okay, well, look, remarkably, we've made it this far without talking about beer. So let's, and of course, Green King are a brewer, the likes of Green King IPA, Old Speckled Hen, some of which you've already mentioned, Nick, and we've had some questions on beer from the Marketing Society, so we'll ask a few. And firstly, I guess, interesting space, but how do you feel, Nick, around some of the new challenges? Let's use BrewDog as a good example. We've kind of felt like very quickly have gone from kind of brewer into kind of bricks and mortar estate. How do you feel about those sort of new challenger brands coming into the market?
Yeah, look, I think in some ways it's good because it challenges us. I think BrewDog have done a really good job, actually, in what they've done over the last few years, and you know, have created some really loyal followings and have been able to switch into operating pubs as well. I think, you know, the challenge for people like us, and you know, we've been around since 1799. We are the original craft brewer, and I try and tell people that when they come to the brewery. You know, people talk about craft being really prominent in the market, which it is right now, but you know, you walk around Arbroath St Edmunds Brewery, you go to Belhaven Brewery in Scotland, and that is craft brewing, but it's craft brewing on scale. But the challenge for us is, you know, our bigger brands, our Cask Ales, our Green King IPA, Abbott, etc., are all operating in, you know, very strong brands with good market position, but in a declining market. And Cask Ale is declining year on year, and will continue to do so, actually. So the challenge for people like us is, how do you adapt to more of those, those much more modern ales that, you know, are evolving and changing all the time. And when you're a mass brewer, that's quite hard. But we, you know, we're trying to adapt to that right now. And, you know, we do a lot of innovation, and we have, you know, a market in which to put our innovation with our pubs. So it's quite a challenge for us to be able to adapt and change quickly, whereas a lot of these the new craft brewers are able to, you know, to change quickly to consumer demand, because we're brewing on they're brewing on a much smaller scale. So we are in the process of doing that. We are in the process of making sure we can adapt. And what we know we're very, very good at is brewing the products. You know, the quality and the taste you get from Green King beers, you know, is second to none, and we can deliver that. Where we've then got to work on is, how do you nurture brands, create them, and make sure they're credible? And, you know, as you know, the consumer in that market is quite fickle. They want to take a different view, you know, on what they're going to consume literally on a week-by-week basis. And we've got to adapt to that and make sure that we can create those brands, create those propositions that compete in those marketplaces. So over time, we will shift our balance from being predominantly cask ale driven to maintaining the cask brands and maintaining our market position in those, but driving much more into the cask beers, the craft beers, which are often more keg driven, will be innovating much more in that area of the market. And you know, it's a big shift, because it's a different discipline and a different understanding of the customer, but it's something I'm sure we're going to be able to adapt to.
We don't let any of our guests leave really without asking them about their favourite TV ad. So hopefully this won't come as too much of a surprise. But Jeremy, we'll come to you first. Can you tell us about your favourite TV ad and why you've chosen it?
Well, it's a beer ad, quite relevantly.
Good.
a whole section of beer ads that I think were probably now, you know, pretty insensitive probably not suitable. But back in the day, which for me was late 80s, in my advertising days, I worked for Saatchi & Saatchi, and one of their big accounts was Castlemaine Forex. I think the whole kind of series of ads, the writing, the very dry, poignant last words were always very amusing, because I don't think anything like that had sort of taken you away on that sort of journey. They characterized a whole feeling of that kind of outback Australia that was so evocative, you know, even though you'd never been there, and related to the product, which not necessarily the greatest product, but certainly some of the greatest advertising. And it really struck a chord, I think, for us working around it. You know, it was one of those brands that was kind of hallowed in the agency, and if you got to work on it, it was really great. But it was also, I think, highly successful and launched a product into the market that for some time held a significant share. So yeah, a great series of ads that brought a smile to your face.
And Jeremy, as we're an audio medium, I'll ask you if you may to do your best to describe kind of what was happening in those ads.
I think probably the favourite of mine is the ute, the typical Australian ute outside the grocery shop, being loaded up case after case for the sheep shearers who are heading off to the station out back. And the shopkeeper says, "And what about something for the ladies?
Something for the ladies?
Oh yeah, two bottles of sweet cherry, mate."
Loads them onto the back of the ute, which collapses the suspension, and the whole lot falls off and turns around to the shopkeeper and says, "It's the sherries that did it."
Australians wouldn't give a Castlemaine 4X for anything else.
And Nick, ask the same question to you, if we may. Kind of what would be your favourite TV ad, and why have you chosen it?
So I'm not going to do beer, but I'm not a marketeer, by the way. So, you know, these dirty property people don't have much of a marketing pedigree, but so I've sort of dug into my memory bank a little bit. I loved, and this I guess was brand advertising, that I, you know, the first time I'd really seen it and thought, "What? How the hell does that relate to the products?" was the Cadbury's advert with the gorilla playing the drums to Phil Collins. And I showed my kids it actually a few weeks ago, and they were like, "What the hell is that all about?" But loved it. And I think, you know, you look back on that and you play it again, and it does sort of make, you know, it gives a bit of a hairs on the back of your neck standing up when you watch that. And I think, you know, really incredible piece of thinking actually about just trying to get people to think differently about a brand. But I love that advert. I think it was amazing and very brave actually for whoever developed it. So if anyone is listening who was involved in developing that TV, well done to you. My other one, because I'm going to go for two, because, you know, I like to push a little bit.
Why not?
But it goes back to my Merlin days, actually, and it's created through music. So all the Alton Towers TV ads go back to a piece of music that includes, it is Hall of the Mountain Kings, which was basically the sort of theme tune of Alton Towers. And every time I was at Alton Towers, you hear that piece of music. It runs through every single piece of advertising that has been done over many, many years around Alton Towers, and I just think about putting, you know, an emotive piece of music to create connection with a brand is really interesting, and it will live long in my memory bank, because that was one of the businesses that I was heavily involved in.
Well, definitely a parallel across both your choices there is the power of the music that's involved. So
yeah.
Brilliant. Well, great choices. Well, look, Nick, Jeremy, thank you both so much for your time. It's been a very fascinating chat, so appreciate your kind of your openness. And yeah, thanks again for joining, and take care.
No problem. Thank
thanks
you.
Thanks so much. It's been great.
too unleash the power of the towers. Buy an Alton Towers season pass. Pay for a day, come back free all season.